From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the ninth day of August 2019. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlo at GlobalAnalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas. Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agribles' Eric Snodgrass will join us to take a look at the weather forecast, and we'll hear that interview I did with Lance Honig at USDA NASS yesterday afternoon about the resurvey of acreage in the United States and how it will be included in Monday morning's USDA reports. And it all happens on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You know, the numbers as they finished up in Chicago. Nearby corn, 0.75 cents lower at $4.10 1/4. December at $4.17 3/4, 0.5 cents lower. And soybeans were up 8 3/4 today. In the August at $8.73 3/4. November contract there at $8.91 3/4, 8 3/4 higher. Bean oil 55 cents higher. Bean meal 1.90 higher. And wheat futures into soft red up a penny at $4.99 1/2. We're now joined by Mike Zuzlo at GlobalAnalytics.biz. Hey, Mike, good afternoon.
Todd, it's another hot, dry Friday in Northeast Kansas, and we're about tired of it.
Yeah, well, rainfall would be welcome, I think, everywhere. We did have a little bit of rain here, so I guess the green grass came back slightly overnight, but that's not enough just yet.
Well, I talked to several of the Douglas County guys today, and I don't think they got much of that, so keep that to yourself.
We'll see what we can do. Maybe a little bit late on that note. Hey, is it the dry weather, the exports? What's happening in the soybean market today?
Yeah, I think we are ending the week here like we started it, where we had another negative push of President Trump's tariff rhetoric, talking about liking the tariffs. More importantly, talking about the Chinese meeting may not be happening because the Chinese clearly want a deal with Huawei before they come to the table. And President Trump made it clear on Friday that he wanted a U.S.-China trade deal first, and then we talk about Huawei. And so we initially got a risk-off fear-type market and mindset returned. And then all of a sudden, about a half an hour later, we saw the dollar started to sink, the crude oil started to make new highs, and the market started to come back in the outside markets as a whole. I think that was very beneficial for soybeans. My general rule of thumb is if you have a stock market that is strong, the beans are going to pick up extra positive sensitivity to that. If you have a crude oil market that is strong, you're going to have extra positive sensitivity through the bean oil as a result of that. And while bean oil was, you know, kind of muted today, I do think it's still built some psychological support. But I think that was probably about 50% of the trade. And I think what you just talked about the weather or the hot, dry weather, the GFS model being drier, even at midday than it was in the morning, and actually now as dry as the European model for Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, that's the other 50%, I think, that brought the beans back in and made them the bull side of the bull spread.
Hey, thanks for joining our Commodity Week conversation yesterday, which brings me to my next question. We talked a lot about the dollar. You said it sank today. Is that good news in the longer term, or is it just a daily trade?
Yeah, right now it's just daily, Todd. I would love it if the dollar would go through this week's low, this current week's low we're finishing up, because that was also the 100-day moving average. And I think that would mean a lot to the funds and the fund community if we would take out a major moving average like that, because that kind of combines and gets really close to a 50 and a 52-week moving average as well. So that's one of the things that I think is almost a must-have in order for me to open up the upside in corn and beans. Even with weather, even with USDA coming in with a very good report Monday, I really wonder if we can get much above 475, 465 D's corn and 960, 965 NOV beans, because the idea that we are still in primarily a supply weather-driven market keeps me in the mindset that I want to continue to hedge profitable levels once I have a good idea of what my yields are. And that's a big if, and that means I stay with bought puts or put spreads so that I am not putting myself and my client too far out there in case their yields come in a lot worse than expected come harvest time and they can't make their bushel commitments to their elevators. But we really do need the commodity demand bear to feel like it's over, it's done and over with. And Friday was a great example of now we go into a weekend where President Trump has ratcheted up the record, ratcheted up the rhetoric at the end of the week. Now it's China's next move on the chessboard. And I really do think the political issues are getting hot enough, and the things going on in Hong Kong, the things going on with North Korea, the things going on with Iran, the things going on with Syria, these are kind of China and Russia centric. And if we go much further and then get into a deeper, more almost military or violent issue, confrontation, I think that dollar becomes a safe haven. And I only bring that up because that's what history has shown. After you have tariffs and economic trade wars and things like that, it's not hard to cross over into more of a physical issue. And that's when the dollar becomes more of a safe haven.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate you taking the time with me today.
Thanks for having me on Commodity Week, Todd. And thanks. Have a great weekend.
Hey, you too, and thanks so much for joining us on Commodity Week. That was recorded yesterday, by the way. Mike Zuzulo was there, along with Elaine Cubb of Mastering the Grain Markets, and Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Agri-Marketing, and Kevin Van Trump of the Van Trump Report joined us as well. It was a really great show. You can listen to it this afternoon on our home radio station, many of these radio stations over the weekend, and of course, always up online at willag.org. Let's turn our attention now to the weather forecast. Agrible and Nutrien Ag Solutions, Eric Snodgrass is here. Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
You know, here in our part of the world, Eric, we got a little rainfall yesterday afternoon. It wasn't too bad. I'm wondering how widespread it might have been, though, across the Midwest.
Yeah, it really was. We watched this lingering boundary that just kind of slid basically east to west across Ohio, Indiana, over into Illinois. And many of us were out here, like right where I live, just staring up at the sky saying, please come in. And as we're progressing so slowly, I even got my drone out and flew up there to see if they were anywhere near us, to see if they'd come over. And we didn't get much rain either. We actually got about 7/100ths of an inch of rain out of it here in Mahomet. And things are dry here. I just checked our 3-foot soil moisture profile. Now, this is a modeled value, but right around here in central Illinois, and this kind of is the same story from us up I-74 toward the Quad Cities. That whole region is sitting somewhere about 30-40% saturated. And that's pretty low, given what we had seen earlier in the year. Another dry spot is up in Indiana as well. So this is that rain was nice, but it was short-lived and a lot of it evaporated. And my yard doesn't look any different today than it did before. And really, you know, I imagine a lot of that rain had a hard time even getting through the canopy down to the soil anyway. So it was nice, but it wasn't what we needed to really end this near-term drought that we've been in.
Speaking of drought, what does the soil profile in the state look like?
Yeah, well, you've seen recently, probably in the U.S. Drought Monitor, that parts of Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana have expanded in their drought in what we call the D0 and D1 categories. But in addition to that, you know, just looking across that whole area I just mentioned, we do see, on average, about 30-50% saturated, and a lot of places slightly below that 30% number. Meanwhile, parts of the North Central Plains, parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin have made a huge recovery and have remained wet in some locations with a lot of thunderstorm activity. It's also been extremely wet through parts of Nebraska and eastern Kansas, western Missouri as of late. Some places there in parts of eastern Kansas have picked up well over 10 inches of rain just in the last couple of weeks alone. So it has been certainly a summertime pattern that's featured a big ridge over the southeast, and therefore we're getting these storm systems that weekly flow through Canada and then flow around that ridge. And so some people get the rain and some people don't, and that's been the name of the game for a while now.
Does that mean we'll get something from the Northwest in the future?
Well, we're watching the Pacific Northwest today. There's a pretty vigorous shortwave moving into the Pacific Northwest, and this has implications for the Corn Belt after it brings quite a bit, I think, of severe weather to Oregon, Idaho, getting into Montana, because that same wave is going to slide over toward the Corn Belt by the time we get into Monday and Tuesday. And now here's the thing we have to try to figure out. Do we keep the moist air in place such that we can use it to make some thunderstorms? And latest model runs with this system coming across keep North, South Dakota, Nebraska, parts of Iowa and Minnesota wet. And then this corridor that stretches from southern Wisconsin to about I-80 running straight east-west over to like Buffalo, New York. Now, the GFS model in the last 3 months has painted that stripe almost every single time with this wetter bias. I mean, places there are getting well above an inch. And if you miss it, it looks like, then it's almost no rain at all. There's going to have some places that are in that dry sector we just talked about not getting anything. Well, this morning's European model wanted to take that same track and just imagine you bend the eastern edge of it south. In other words, take that heavy rain now along I-80, stretch it through northern Indiana and cut right down into Ohio. And that's a pretty substantial difference for the eastern Corn Belt. What I don't like is everything I've just said has been around I-80. So if you were listening to this in Illinois, that seems to be that the best chances of that rain are going to try to stay to our north at this point down here in central Illinois. And we desperately need more rainfall.
It is August. Will it be hot?
Yeah, that's the thing. Out ahead of this next system coming through, we will get our temperatures spiking temporarily. But once this system goes through, by the time we get to Tuesday, we're going to see the pattern across the United States split north-south. North's hanging on to some near average to maybe at times slightly cooler than average temperatures, while the south is going to be baking. I mean, we've already got heat advisors out from Texas all the way over to Georgia today, and that's going to be the name of the game for them for quite some time. So high evapotranspiration rates down south where the heat is staying on and things are staying relatively dry.
Can you look a little further range and maybe talk about what's in the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah, well, right now the Atlantic is really quiet, and that's great. I mean, that's great if you're not in Texas. I mean, I think Texas would love to have a little slow-moving hurricane, a Cat 1, come up and just do some rain. Nothing like, producing big rains, but just something. They've been so dry. Well, I look all the way back over to the west coast of Africa, and I'll tell you, the next 10 days is very dry, dusty. It's also very suppressed convectively. Where it is not that way is over in the West Pacific, and that's a big monkey wrench in our forecast. We have two typhoons right now, one that just made landfall there on the east coast of China. It's heading toward Beijing. Some regions around Beijing may end up picking up 4 to maybe some heavily flooded areas, as much as 10 to 12 inches of rainfall, and that's just south of Beijing where they have a lot of very productive farmland. Now, the problem is these two typhoons, if they go north and get sucked into the jet stream, we're going to have to watch them about 10 to 20 days from now, causing problems in North American weather. So I'm keeping a very close eye on those two typhoons and where they go, because if they affect the flow over Alaska, well, that affects the flow over us. So they are a wild card in the long-range forecast at this point.
Anything in Europe? They were dry early in the season and hot.
Yeah, and Western Europe has since then kind of cooled off a little bit, which has made a lot of those folks happy, but the damage is already done. In the next week or so, the storm track is through Northern Europe, so we're actually expecting quite a bit of rainfall that run through the British Isles and then through the northern parts of Europe into Scandinavia, and warm and dry in the south. But over near Ukraine, near the Black Sea, normal precipitation, but cooler than average weather continues. And I've been saying that now for that region for about a month, so they've had some cool weather to contend with while much of the rest of Western Europe was very, very hot.
And finally, anything in the long-range forecast for the fall?
Yeah, well, as we keep looking out, one of the things that I'm seeing here is that the rest of August does look to carry a warm bias for much of the United States. If any place shows up with a slight cool bias, it's going to be probably the Canadian prairies in the far northern part of the United States. So we're going to continue with the warmer spell. Now, the question for September gets tricky. I'll tell you what we're going to be watching together. In the Pacific, North Pacific, big warm blob of water and sea ice is relatively low. We still have a very, very weak, we'd also call this just a no signal coming out of El Nino and the El Nino region, which means we're going to have to watch tropical activity and we're going to have to watch Greenland and Alaska for blocking. So those things are too big of a wild card for me to pin them down right now. But I'll say this, whenever we've had that warm blob in the Pacific, it's often given us a favorable end to our growing season. Now, that's not a guarantee. It's not a slam dunk, but it's there. The longer range models, when they were released just earlier this week, though, did trend a little bit cooler for us for our September, October, November time frame. But when I say it trended a little cooler, it was to the tune of about a half degree. So this isn't something that I think is a strong signal in the models just yet.
Hey, thanks so much, Eric.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. That's Eric Snodgrass. He is with Agrible and Nutrien Ag Solutions. We're joined by Lance Honig. He's the chief of the crops branch at USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Lance, for taking the time with me today. Next week, USDA will release the crop production report. You're responsible for putting those together. It will include this time around a resurvey of the Midwest Corn Belt states as it relates to acreage. Can you background me again on why that's the case this year?
Sure. We went back and resurveyed in 14 states, like you said, primarily across the Midwest. Obviously, weather this spring, very unusual across a wide swath of states. Not only heavy rainfall, but extended rainfall really caused a lot of planting delays, and in some cases, didn't allow some farmers to get all the crops planted that they wanted. So when we did our survey work back in the early part of June, early to mid-June, for our acreage report, there was more acres left to be planted than there typically would be at that time. So what we did was we actually went back in those 14 states, primarily for corn and soybeans, although we did touch a little bit of cotton and sorghum. We actually went back for our area-based survey, and we revisited every field that we had identified in those 14 states for the crops we selected that still had acres left to be planted at that time. And so we went back during July, and we found out what actually happened in every one of those fields. And so that's some of the data that we're looking at right now to try to determine, do we need to make any adjustments to the acreage estimates that we published back on June 28th?
When you arrive at those fields, if they're planted to corn in particular and it's late, is there a way to account for whether those are acres that will not come to harvest and rather go to silage? This has got to be an event that happens every year, so there must be some way that you account for that. Maybe it's just in the harvested acres figure.
Well, it's really a great point that you raised, Todd. The fact that really what's different this year is really it's about magnitude. Right. I mean, we're talking about a much larger area. We're talking about a lot longer period of challenge for some folks. But the bottom line is we do see planting delays somewhere almost every year. So our procedures are already set up to handle this. From that standpoint, we were prepared for this. It's just a little bigger scale than what we would normally see, and therefore it's got really a lot more attention than you would normally see. So when we're talking about either the original June area survey or the resurvey, we're doing the same thing both times. We don't just go to that field. We actually talk to the farmer who is operating that land. So absolutely, for corn in particular, we not only find out how many acres were planted, but we find out how many of those acres did they intend to harvest at that point for grain. We actually ask how many for silage or other uses. So we do have a mechanism to find out what the expected outcome of those planted acres are. And so this year is no different, and we'll use that information not only to evaluate how many acres were planted, but also the harvested piece as well.
I'd like to roll this forward into the crop production numbers. We'll be facing a similar problem with a lot of the June planted corn, that it's simply very late. How do you, in this particular report, and it, again, must happen in some space in most years, how are you able to account for corn that is still in the pollination period or very early in the grain fill period?
Well, you know, the later you are, the more challenging it is in any year. This year, as we look particularly this month, what we're doing is we're doing really a couple of things to try to evaluate yield. The first and really foremost thing that we do is we survey farmers, and we ask the farmers, what do you expect your yield to be? And, you know, they're thinking about things like, here's where my crop's at, here's what it's faced up to this point. And so they're going to give us their best estimate of what they expect that yield to be. At the same time, we're also out there pulling down satellite information and looking at, the crop from that perspective to try to determine what we think those yields are going to be. And so we're weaving that all together. But, you know, we always have to remember that there's two key points about a yield forecast from NASS, whether it's corn or any other crop. The first is it's based on conditions as of the first of that month. So we're going to be basing it on what was going on August 1st. And then the second, which might be an even bigger point to remind folks of, is we assume normal weather for the remainder of the year. So obviously when you're late like this, You know, you have concerns if you're a producer about what if we get an early frost, what if. We're not making any adjustments on potential for what might happen out of the ordinary. So we're going to take the information that we get from the farmers. They tell us what they expect their yields to be. We're going to compare that with how that typically relates to final yields. We're going to look at the satellite information we have, and we're going to make a determination based on the conditions that we have August the 1st.
And one final note, I believe this is the case, and I'm not certain. When you do the ear counts per acre for this particular report and the rest of the crop production reports through the fall, that changes from one report to the other, and it usually goes up, I believe. Is there a statistical reason why that happens?
Well, first of all, just a quick reminder that we don't have objective yield information for August starting this year. Remember, we made an announcement a few months back that starting this year, you know, for corn and soybeans in particular, and even cotton, we're not going to do the objective yield work for the August report. We're going to start that here in a few weeks, gearing up for the September forecast. So that's a change that's being implemented in this report. But as you see, some of those counts change from the first month to the second month. There's a couple of reasons that can happen, and one of which is we typically don't pick up all the samples that first month, or in the past we haven't. Now, again, with the, you know, starting a month later this year, we're going to pick them all up right away that first month. But so that can be a big driver behind some of those counts changing, because you're pulling more samples into the process moving forward, at least in years past.
And one final question. The FSA acreage report has been moved up, or is it a different time than the rest of the reports for later months? This time around, it will be released at the same time as the crop production numbers. Is there a reason for that this time?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. This one will come out at noon Eastern time, or be posted to their website at noon Eastern time, which is the same time as the crop production and the WASDE reports. And, you know, here at USDA, we worked together on that, and we really felt that, you know, again, with some of the issues that we've just talked about, acreage is really a very critical topic right now. And we just felt it was important that all of that information come out at the same time. Come Monday, obviously, you know, as I mentioned, we've done some resurvey work. We're looking at FSA data. We're looking at remote sensing information on acreage. And, you know, as a result of that, if any changes are needed, we'll publish updated estimates on in the report on the 12th. And since FSA data is one of those components that we're looking at, we just felt that it was really in the best interest of everyone to have access to all that information at the same time, rather than have to wait, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours after seeing one report to see what was in the other. So, that was a conscious decision that was made here at USDA to hopefully better serve the data user community out there.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd. Always happy to be on.
Lance Honig is the chief of the crops branch at the United States Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C. USDA reports are due at 11 a.m. Central Time. Crop production, WASDE, and the FSA numbers on Monday morning. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.